Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Hey, thanks for checking out the Bobby Bones Show podcast. I wanted to share an episode of the Bobbycast. It's a show that I do mostly from my house, where I talk to songwriters, artists, managers, and more. You know, earlier this year, one of my buds, Thomas Rhett, stopped by the house. And so we talked about a lot of stuff. I talked to TR about growing up with a famous dad, who's Rhett Akins, what it's like to prepare and even play live on SNL, and how back in the day he used to write a lot with Chris Stapleton. It's good. And by the way, this was the first time he ever shared that him and his wife were expecting another baby. I mean, by now, you know, but it's kind of a big deal at the time. If you like this episode, you can subscribe to the Bobbycast and hear more. It's just kind of more in-depth about what's happening in music and art. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or listen on iHeartRadio or wherever you get your podcasts. Here's episode 189 of the Bobbycast. All right, welcome to... You want a water?
Sure.
Would you mind getting our esteemed guest here a water? Welcome to episode 189 of the Bobbycast.
189?
Yeah, it took you that long to get
that
here.
That is 100, nuts.
189 episodes.
I'm just late to the party.
Thomas Rhett's here.
Thanks, dude.
At Thomas Rhett Akins on Instagram. 3.7 million followers, I see. I do see sometimes, though. By the way, glad to finally have you here. I think it took a... I'm always weirded out about asking, like, buddies to do work things.
Dude.
Because there gets to be a point where you go, you know what? I kind of like the relationship.
Right.
Of being buds.
Right.
Instead of going, hey, what about this work project that I'm working? You know, that was kind of a fuzzy line for me.
Yeah, but I've told you that I've wanted to do this for a while.
I know, but still, I'm like, you know what? I don't ever want to go. So this is what I did. This was the move. Was I was like, hey, TR says he wants to do this. I would like for him to do it. So I had my management talk to your management.
And you hate that.
it just gives everybody a chance to say no for somebody.
Right, yeah.
Because if you really didn't want to do it, then someone else could say no for you.
That's true.
You know, Harry or Virginia could have
sure,
been like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, he can't do it. You know, he's got a circumcision. Dude, you know, something like that.
No, dude, me and you have been talking about doing this for forever. This is something that like I'm into. I haven't done many podcasts either.
This is also going to be a national special. No pressure.
Oh, so what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool.
but it is good to have you here.
Likewise, man.
What's annoying about you in the best way is we were doing the CMA Fest together. And you're actually really good on camera.
Really?
Yeah.
It means a lot coming
and
from you.
And it's so frustrating because I've like been doing it forever. And like, oh, and I'm like, all right, I finally
I was asking you for advice the entire time we were there.
No, I finally have this one skill set. And then I walk up and you're just killing it with the prompter.
Hey, that was my fourth year to do that.
And I'm like, does this guy do anything bad?
Oh, please. There's a lot. There's a lot I do bad.
I don't know. Well,
I don't Peloton as good as you.
That's probably true. I'm a beast on the bike.
I know.
But you don't even have one. But you're like me, though. I think you'd be competitive.
Well, when I get a Peloton, so I can just add you as a friend.
We can be friends and
okay,
compete.
Okay, sick.
Because I have a couple. Are you still working out with the mirror?
I do it occasionally. I've really gotten into running lately, and as much as I hated it in the beginning, it's something that like I look forward to every day now.
Where are you running?
Just around the neighborhood.
How long?
And we
are you
live
running?
In a hilly neighborhood. My goal is to eventually do like a half marathon, but I think when you have kids, it's kind of impossible to train completely for that. The longest I've ever ran was 4 miles. Around Lipscomb.
I get so bored running.
You need to do this app.
Yeah, I've done
the Nike Run Club app, dude.
I'm telling you.
He talks to you the whole way through.
I did the Nike, well, maybe not the same one, and they get so advanced and so much better every time, but I did a Nike app for, it was a couple years ago. And I've done a couple triathlons, like Olympic triathlons.
Have you really?
I have.
That's swim
a mile.
Bike and run.
Bike 26 miles.
Holy.
And then run 6.
And you trained for it, obviously.
Yeah, I did.
Dude.
But I hated it.
You hated it. You
hated
all the
training.
You were doing,
I hate it. I hate
even while you were doing it.
I hate exercising.
But you do it all the
every
time.
Day.
You do it all the time.
I'm going to do a name drop. You know, my people that listen give me a hard time sometimes if I just straight name drop without saying name drop.
Yeah.
But I was talking to Keith Urban, and we were talking about how he stays thin.
Right.
He was like, what are you doing just to actually stay thin? You're so thin all the time.
Yeah.
And he's one to talk. Right.
Right? No, he's pretty thin, yeah.
And I was like, the bike, man.
Yeah.
I get on this bike and I hate every second of it, but I can compete on the bike. Like I have friends right. that I race against.
Like you have to compete to work out.
I need
much.
To.
Right.
Or play ball.
Yeah.
I'm not good at running against myself. That's why I don't like running. Like I did right. an app where the zombies chase you.
I need to download that.
That's
ASAP.
About the only thing that,
that
got me running.
That is amazing. What is that?
It was like a zombie running app. And then I just realized, you know what? They're never going to catch me. They're not real. And then I would be like, all
true.
Right, who cares? They're not catching me.
Yeah.
Me. But like you play ball as a kid, right?
Yeah, I played sports all growing up. I played baseball until I was like 13 or 14, and then football and soccer were my main sports. oddly, I was too little for football. I sucked at football.
You were a good soccer player, oddly.
I was a good soccer player.
What was the soccer scene like in Georgia?
Well, no, I grew up in Nashville.
So, but you were, okay, you were born in Valdosta.
Born in Valdosta.
When did you move to Nashville?
I moved to Nashville at 2.
Oh, so you lived here your whole life?
Basically, yeah.
Oh, so you played, okay, there's a decent soccer scene here.
Yeah, so I went to Good Pasture, which is like 20 minutes north of here. And we went, I'm trying to think, we went to state my junior year. I just wish I was in that kind of shape. Dude, I could run for a day.
Yeah, that's soccer.
And not stop.
And you were a pretty good soccer player. Well, you thought maybe if you'd wanted to, you could have maybe played up at like a small college or?
Well, my goal, like I tore my ACL when I was 17. So that kind of ruined all of my hopes and dreams for you know, playing soccer in college. But I probably could have maybe walked on at Lipscomb, but I don't think I wanted a job in college.
It's so annoying how good you are at everything. Music and freaking TV and sports.
Please.
Give me a break. I come over here struggling for any sort of skill set whatsoever.
And now you have all of them.
Look at you. Just killing it. All right, where do we start with you? Because I feel like I follow E! News and E! On Instagram.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They love you guys.
They do. It's hilarious when they post about us, though, because I would say 80% of the comments are like, who are these people?
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just like a country to more worldwide following, but a lot of people are just like, I have no idea who these people are. Same with People Magazine.
I went through a bit of that. Well, when American Idol announced me.
Yeah.
And they covered it, you know, E! Or, and they're like,
right.
Who?
Right.
Or, you know, when I did Dancing with the Stars and
yeah,
they were like, who? The whole time. It's just a bunch of who.
I saw you're about to be on Family Feud.
We lost last night.
It was already on.
It was on last
night. I don't watch TV, man.
Yeah.
How was it?
It was an awesome experience.
Yeah.
But I'm so competitive, as we've talked about.
Right.
We go on and we go to the final question and we lose on the final question.
Who were the people on your team?
So the cool thing was they said, bring whoever you want.
Oh, cool.
They said, bring your friends. They're like, it's Celebrity Family Feud. There are no rules.
I appreciate the invite.
If I go next time, because they invited me back, you want to come next time, next
Absolutely.
Year? Okay, if you're free, they'll tape early next year. You can come be on the team.
I would love to do that.
Awesome. It was so fun. You would love. It's just one of those fun things. Like yeah. Aside, so I called Party and Lauren Elena.
Oh, cool.
I'm close to them.
Yeah.
And I knew I wouldn't have to like do anything except be a friend.
Right, yeah.
And that's not a work thing, but I called Party and Elena and then Amy and Lunchbox.
Cool.
And so we go up and it goes to the final question. And you tell me what you would answer here. Something okay. Worn above the waist that starts with B.
Above the waist. I'm assuming a belt doesn't.
A belt?
Is that would at be, the waist.
Yeah, okay. Take a few answers here and see if you would guess.
Gosh, man.
Because we missed it. We didn't get the final.
Above the waist, a bra?
Okay, bing, there's one.
What is a bassinet?
So you put the baby in? Don't you? You have babies.
Yeah. I never wore a bassinet.
No, you put the baby in it. It's like
oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, sorry. I did use that.
I never wore a bassinet either. You shouldn't wear a bassinet.
I can't think of anything else.
The answer that we didn't get and no one got was blouse. And we were like,
oh,
what
blouse.
Is this, 1972?
Yeah, right.
Who says blouse?
Did the other team get blouse?
No, but since we didn't get it, both teams
gotcha.
Lost and
yeah.
They went on. But we lost and I was so irritated that everybody went to dinner afterward.
And you just didn't.
Nope. I'm not a bad sport.
Yeah?
It's
just a tough loser.
Just it hurt.
Yeah, no. I feel you, dude.
It meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
And so I
what's your
out.
Enneagram number? Have you done
Eight.
That? Okay.
Eight, then one.
Okay. I'm a 4.
Which is?
Well, I need to reread it, but it's basically a...
Mike, will you look up what 4 and 8 are?
It's a creative, but like I'm like an average 4, which means like I ask a bunch of opinions on my creativity. If I don't get the answer back that I need, it's like destructing. Does that make sense?
What do you mean the answer that you need?
So like, I guess like as a songwriter, if I wrote a bunch of songs in a weekend and I sent them to people that I trust on my team, like, what do you think about this? And I think it's great, but they don't think it's my best work, then I'm just defeated completely. Mm. So that's like my average 4, but on my good days, I can trust my gut and go with it. Oh, here we are.
So a 4 is you're a 4, right?
4.
You're a individualist, a romantic individualist.
Yeah. It's pretty accurate.
Yeah?
And you're an 8, protective challenger.
A challenger.
Oh, yeah. I see that.
You know, I will send songs off, because I rewrite comedy songs, and we're doing a tour right now that's partial stand-up, partial
yeah.
two-man comedy. And I have someone that I send music to, and like, is this funny? And if he goes, no. Okay, let's say you send a song off to Harry,
yeah.
right? And like, what do you think about this? And he goes, that's pretty good. Not your best,
right.
but pretty good. Well, how does that make you feel?
Makes me feel like you should have been in the room to feel what we felt when we wrote it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I sent it to you, but then it's like, well, how can you judge it when you don't know how the context of how we wrote it? I get defensive, I think, about it.
But then you do see after a breath, you go, you know what? he wasn't supposed to be in the room. No one else was going to be in the room that ends up hearing the song.
Yeah.
Do you feel that? Do you ever come back around to it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And they say that fours at their best can, they don't have to have the opinions that they need. They can, in the end, they can trust their gut, which I would say my strong four is a lot less happening than my average four. So
if I send a song off and I'm like, this is funny, and it comes back, because I sent one off recently and I was like, hey, is this funny? Because as you know, when you get into a project, I do it like when I write books too. I'm like, I don't even think this is any good anymore. After I've spent a lot of time on it, you lose your sense. At least I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You lose your sense of, oh, is this even like good?
Absolutely.
I've been in it so long. I don't even,
right.
I'm looking around. I don't even know what's good and what's not anymore. And so I send it off and I go, is this funny? And he sent one back. He goes, not really.
Oh gosh, that's the worst.
And I went.
But what does that do to you?
Oh, I go, okay, wait for the next one then.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Like, so you like get competitive with it.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, just like, scrap that. Write something new.
Or I'll go, it's two things. It's like, wait for the next one, sucker. Or
right.
let me beef this one up with some more jokes.
Got it.
So I'll sit back down. It's just funny how like different
creatives.
So interesting,
man. I wish I had that. I wish I had that so bad.
I think you're doing all right, if I were just to guess.
No, it's fine. It's just like, it's when you sit there and slave away over a song for 6 hours and you send it to somebody and they're like, this is not your best work. You're like, well, what do you know? Then, you know, the defensive part comes out in you.
How long does it take to not get defensive?
I'm getting to where I don't get as defensive. I just kind of have to breathe and just kind of let it go. But I don't know, man. I take my creative work so seriously, as you do. And then when you've been doing it now, I've been doing it for 8 years writing songs, you feel like you get to a point where, you know how Tiger Woods has that quote, like, make sure that you're, even on your worst day, it's like, for Tiger, a bad day is shooting a 72.
Right.
His good day is like a 64. So it's like, I feel like I'm kind of at the point now where even my bad songs, they still can't, I don't think I can consider them a bad song. I just feel like as many songs as I've written that I feel like are great songs, they kind of have to keep getting greater. And then comes the pressure of going, well, crap, I feel like that was great. How do you top great and make it awesome?
It's, you know, it's funny.
Never ending grind.
You bring that up. I think a lot of people struggle with that. I think, you know, in my second book that I wrote, I did a whole thing on, it's not about making your best better. It's about making your worst better.
Yeah, that's true.
Because if you can make your bottom line rise,
yeah,
your high line rises automatically.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
And anybody can hit an amazing shot occasionally.
Yeah.
But it's, can you make your worst shots better all the time?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's funny. That's what you're saying. That's how you feel about your songwriting.
Totally.
Too, that your worst songs are better now.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That means your best songs are far
better. Great. Yeah, yeah, you're right. I haven't ever thought about it like that. That's good.
You ever just leave a room and go, now that was a freaking song.
Yes.
Like a special song. Holy crap.
Yeah, for sure.
Which one did that happen
with? They're few and far between, though, man, because I think, like, I get asked the question a lot, what does it take to be a good songwriter? And I think, obviously, you need to be able to craft words and have great melodies, but I think great ideas are harder to come across than write great songs.
Like concepts?
Concepts. You know what I mean? Like, for me, like, I sit down and I go, okay, what could I write today that the world hasn't heard from me? You know what I'm saying? But that's also believable for me. Like, when I sit down and somebody brings up a sad song idea, there's 80% of my brain that goes, I don't know that people want to hear anything that they don't know about me just yet. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's like you go to I play shows and, you know, you talk about Lauren in your show, you talk about the kids in your show, and I think that's what people know of me and they want to hear that from me. But how many different ways can you write a love song and how many different ways can you write about your kids, when the reason I fell in love with country music in the first place was I'm a sucker for sad songs. And so Marry Me is definitely the saddest I've ever gone, but it's still kind of related to my story a little bit. And so for me to sit down and write a song that's just like sad just for the sake of being sad, I'm not sure what that would do on a record of mine. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, on a record of yours. But if I were to pivot that a bit and go, do you ever write for others anymore?
Yeah, I do.
Now, mindset's got to be a bit different.
Yeah.
If you're writing a sad song, do you ever write for generic or do you go in and write for people specifically?
I write generic. One song of every 10, you know what I'm saying? In hopes that like, maybe this is a hit for somebody, you know what I'm saying? And not that generic is bad. Like I do think that a lot of the time in the songwriting world, we overthink it a little bit. And we think that every song has to be this amazing, insane concept, but sometimes people just want to feel good. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes those songs don't have to be, you know, worldly life-changing. They just need to be a good melody that you can dance to. So
John Mayer did this with me and we were talking about that exactly. And yeah, that guy is brilliant.
Brilliant.
Like,
yeah.
Think he's just a different all around guy. Like yeah, all of him's different. and it's amazing and awful and awesome. I love them.
Yeah, me too.
And so he was talking about just that. He goes, you know, as a creator, we're constantly going, how do I make my next thing really amazing and like stretch myself and be the most artistic? And he goes, in reality, you know what people love? Waiting on the world to change. Like one of my most down the middle songs.
Totally.
That was just like, okay, here's this.
Yeah.
He goes, and people sing it and love it. Like in the mass amount of people love songs meant for the mass amount of people.
It's true.
And I thought, wow, that's a really simple, but that's really right.
Yeah, for sure.
And as I'm going, I wonder why I can really stretch, be funny, make people think.
Yeah, for sure.
People don't even love those jokes that much.
I know. And you think like a lot of the time you're in the writing room, you're going, oh my gosh, I think this is one of the best songs I've ever written. And you get out on stage and you play it and nobody cares. Because it's just not the right setting. You know what I mean? Like there's certain settings for songs. Like if you write like a real intense, amazing concept of a country song and it's really slow and it's like some songs are meant for the bluebird and some songs are meant for 25,000 people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like some songs people want to freaking party and sing to.
Absolutely.
And sometimes they want to sit in the coffee house.
Yeah.
Or the Bluebird Cafe and like feel emo.
Yeah, right.
What is your biggest, we'll call it a 25,000 person song. Which song do you play that in your set that people are like, all right, let's go?
Dude, yeah, me and my radio team talk about this quite a bit because in the country world, just like every other world, everybody focuses so hard on number ones, right? And when you really pick apart what a number one means, there's a few different kinds of number ones. There's number ones that just got to number one. There's number ones that were reactive. And then there's songs that don't go number one that maybe because they were just terrible or because they might have been too progressive for the time.
Because people didn't get it.
Yeah. So like if you come to my concert, we put a single out on the second record called Vacation that died at 33 on the chart. That
jam.
Was so how did he do that so
because
fast?
Because I thought this would be your song.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and we've actually talked about this a little bit too, where I thought the song kind of got jobbed.
Dude.
Because I felt like there were just some people, like in our industry, there were just some older white men who are like, that's not country.
Right, yeah. And there, you know, there's certain people that like certain stuff and that don't, and that's fine because everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But you come to my concert, this feels like it was set at number one for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I love the song. You played it on New Year's Eve, and I remember texting you going, dude, that song's a jam.
I know.
Like, I can't believe, I think you came in on the show. Anyway, I love the song too.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's a rocker, huh, the shows?
It feels like it was a smash for forever. And I think those are things you have to keep in mind while you're writing songs. It's like, yeah, you want hits because hits, especially for new artists, in my opinion, hits are what take you to that level where you can afford a couple of misses. You know what I'm saying? After you get a couple hits. And not you don't have to have hits to make it. I'm not saying that at all because there's been artists that haven't had number ones ever on the radio that are gigantic. But I think it's kind of a disservice as a songwriter to go, well, I'm not going to put this out because I don't think this is number one. Because even if it dies at 10 and it was reactive, that to me, that's far more of a win than having a number one that didn't do anything.
We just did a whole show on this about number twos that never hit number one.
Yeah.
And songs that just never hit number one that were massive for artists.
Right. Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy died at like 25.
Yeah, there are a lot of those songs that are like the artist's quintessential song.
Yeah.
And these artists have had 15 number ones, but their quintessential song is not a number one song.
Right.
Keith Urban's been that guy.
Totally.
Where he's had massive songs that did not hit number one.
Yeah.
What is your ultimate coffeehouse song?
Like that I've written?
Yeah.
Trying to think. Probably this song on my last record called Kiss Me Like a Stranger. Never in a million years would it be a hit on radio, but it was just one that I just felt the vibe.
Who'd you write that with?
Jordan Reynolds and Dave Barnes.
Oh, I'm close with Dave.
Yeah, and I wrote with Dave last week.
Isn't he so funny?
Hilarious.
We're talking to him now about his podcast, and Dave and I get along really well. But
yeah.
And he's an awesome artist. Like, I remember Dave back in the day.
Such an amazing artist, yeah.
When he was, you know, doing the Matt Wirtz.
Dude, when I first met Dave Barnes, the first thing I said, because I've been a huge fan since, like, college, I was like, dude, you don't know me, but the first time I ever made out with somebody in college was to on a night like this.
That's what'd he say?
He just laughed.
Yeah. He's a funny dude.
Yeah.
Something to do with my hands. Let's go back to that one. What? You have put your hand down, your head down in your hand. Why do you do that?
Because I think that song is the perfect expression for an artist evolving into a different space. when I first started singing, when I first became an artist, I wanted to be Eric Church more than anything in the world. I mean, Jay Joyce was my producer who produces Eric Church. Like, all I listened to in high school was Eric Church. I mean, still to this day, there's a lot of components about my songwriting that really, I think, kind of resemble Church's way of writing, just a lot of storytelling. But when I listen to this song, I don't even know that guy.
Well, that's good. You shouldn't know that guy at this point.
Right, yeah. Like, we haven't played that song in our live show in like 4 years.
Does anyone ever request it though? Like, you see them at meet and greet?
No, and that's how you know.
And you wrote
that's
that
how you know.
Oddly with Lee
Stapleton.
Miller and
yeah.
Stapleton.
Yep.
Do yeah. you remember that specific write?
I do. Man, me and Stapleton used to write like 2 times a week back when I was maybe like 20 years old, 2010, 2011. We used to write all the time, man. I was digging through my Dropbox the other day of songs written before 2015, and there's so many Stapleton work tapes and songs that I still think could be viable to record on a record of mine today. Me and Stapleton have written once, maybe in 4 years, but that's just because that dude is so busy now. We're both so busy, but I used to love writing with Stapleton.
Was he full beard?
Oh, yeah.
Back then?
Yep. But, I mean, he obviously is the coolest dude in town now, but even then, if you were in the kind of the Nashville circuit, he was just the coolest dude you've ever seen. And like, you always just wanted to be there in the studio when he sang the vocal because it was pretty life-changing.
You guys also did Crash and Burn together.
We did, yeah.
Is that the song you're talking about when you got back in the room with him, or was that before that?
No, so I didn't write Crash and Burn.
Oh, you didn't write
that? I didn't, no. This was also when I met Jesse Frazier for the first time. Jesse's produced my last 2.5 albums. He did kind of half Tangled Up and the rest of them. And this was how I found Jesse Frazier, because he did this track and built, he had this whole Motown vibe going. And him and Stapleton at the time were writing a ton of songs like this, which is crazy. I think if you were to be a gigantic Stapleton fan today and you got to dive into my Dropbox a little bit, I'd play you a bunch of old Stapleton demos, you would have no idea that was Stapleton.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. A lot of songs like this they wrote.
I think Jesse may be the guy that has more shoes than you and I.
Agreed.
I mean, we like shoes.
That dude is on a new level.
Yeah, he's on a level.
Just like, I mean, his Nike app blows up like 6 times a day. Like, do you want to enter the raffle for this? Or?
Yeah, he's on it. Again, I have a whole closet downstairs full of shoes.
Yeah, same.
But sometimes people come in and you just take the knee.
Yeah.
You know? You just bend the knee to the person who really
Absolutely.
Is the king.
Yeah, he's the original sneakerhead in my life for sure.
What else did you and Stapleton write? Anything that made it?
We wrote a song on my second record called Shake Your South Side. You already got it. You got it teed up. Dude, we played this. We opened our show with this for like 2 straight years, like on Aldean and FGL tour. And this song was actually synced in one of the Chipmunks movies.
They did.
They did like a chipmunk version of this song. Yeah.
So you know how they do those chipmunk voices? Have you heard?
I've never heard it. No.
I listened to How We Made It or one of those podcasts.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Where the guy that invented the chipmunks, he did a whole podcast, and his thing was what they do is, let's say you were going to do the Pledge of Allegiance as a chipmunk.
Yeah.
Because when you do the chipmunk's high voices have to go at normal speed.
Right.
They have to sound like I sound, just a higher pitch. So if I were doing the Pledge of Allegiance, I would do it like this.
Right.
I pledge.
Gotcha.
So you can speed it up, but it still be sped up to normal speed.
Right, yeah.
And so they did that, and they showed how they do the chipmunks.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's kind of like in music videos, if you're going to shoot a super slow-mo scene, they'll speed your song up like double. And you got to do the scene singing your song at double speed so that it looks like it's
Is that right?
slower speed. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What do you have over there, Mike?
Yeah. My claim to fame right there. Oh my gosh, that's so good.
That's funny. That's a cool thing, though.
Yeah, it was cool.
That's like the Chipmunks, or we mentioned Family Feud, or Sesame Street.
Yeah, Sesame Street was awesome.
Like, that's like one of the cool things that, like, that's a life thing.
Absolutely.
What was that like?
It was crazy, man. It was, first of all, it's super cool because I think my kids are definitely too young to have known what Sesame Street was. So when we got the offer, I spent like a week showing them a bunch of old Sesame Street reruns and like Bruno Mars doing the show or whoever doing the show. And they got really excited about Big Bird and like all this stuff. And so when we got up there, my kids went ballistic. Like, it was one of those days, it was like no nap, they're in rare form. And they were so like, when kids, I think, meet those Muppets in real life, it's like they're staring at the hand and they're also watching the guy do the voice, but they don't even care that the guy's doing the voice. They truly think that whatever's on that hand is a real thing. And I grew up watching Sesame Street too, and so did my dad, and so did my mom. And so it was like one of those things that's truly iconic, you know, in our generation, in our parents' generation. And so when I got to do that, it was that and SNL are probably the two coolest things I've gotten to do.
Boy, SNL, that's cool too. Yeah. I remember when they announced you, and we have some of the same team. Our PR team's the same.
Yeah, and shout out to Time.
Yeah, and I have Christy in Time. You know, Christy. But yeah. But I remember them going, ah, T.R. got SNL.
Yeah.
And I was so pumped for you because that's such a, like, it's a life thing.
It is a life thing. I mean, it's, like, just iconic. Like things that, like, performing on the Grammys is one of those things, too. You know, I've never gotten to do that. But doing SNL and Sesame Street were two definite huge things on my bucket list. But also the most terrifying.
What is the SNL vibe like? So you go up when?
Well, so we've been trying to get SNL for almost 2 years. And then it's all about their slot, and it's all about their timing. And we got asked to do it on a Friday, and we did it on the next Saturday.
So a week and a day.
A week and a day to go in the studio or rehearsal space, me and the whole band. We hired like a 4-piece horn section and like a 2-piece choir. And we were rehearsing songs that we'd never even touched as a band. So we did Look What God Gave Her and Don't Threaten Me With a Good Time. And those two songs at that point were barely mixed, much less mastered. And so we're basically learning unmixed, unmastered songs to play live on national television, like 9 days from now. So,
but when you go on, were the songs available?
No. Well, Look What God Gave Her was Look What God Gave Her was mixed and mastered, but Threaten was very much so in the bones of what it was going to be. And so we kind of had to make it up there on the fly. Like, it was recorded, but it was still getting mixed and it hadn't been mastered yet. And so getting choreography down and getting the horn parts right and all that stuff in 3 days is a lot for a band to learn.
So when you played Don't Threaten Me, it wasn't available to stream?
No, it came out like at midnight that night.
Okay, so
yeah.
it at least came out that night. Did you guys have to rush to get it up? Was it one of those where we're going to perform, but we also got to get ready?
Yeah, we weren't supposed to put anything out until a week past that. It was just supposed to be Look What God Gave Her and then wait 3 weeks until the next release. And so we're like, well, we're going to do them. Why would we play them and people not be available to buy them? And so that was a last minute decision on the label's part.
So if the show is on a Saturday night, what's that week like? Like in New York, like when do you go up? When do you meet people? Who do you get to meet?
Yeah. So we got there on Wednesday we got there on Thursday, rehearsed all day Thursday. Like they literally gave us like a 4-hour sound check. So you're playing the songs, you're going to the mixing booth, making sure that all the stuff is mixed right for national television, rehearsing, listening. And then the downtime to me was the hardest part because you're like, okay, we just did it like 100 times. Now we got to wait, 48 hours to actually do it. And so you're in there and you're watching John Mulaney rehearse his stuff. And I was super terrified until I talked to John Mulaney. And he was like, how you feeling? And I was like, really nervous. And he was like, dude, me too. And so like talking to, a comedian that does that professionally, for him you could feel his nerves as well, because I mean, SNL, like I feel like you're judged pretty hard as a comedian on that show. Like if it's not funny and your opening monologue isn't great, then that's something that people talk about. But just watching him get to do that and then I got to meet like Ben Stiller, I got to meet Paul Rudd, the whole cast, and just walking in there, man, I just could feel the whole Will Ferrell, more cowbell skit. Like it's crazy how much history you could feel just walking in that building. And so, Friday was the off day. And as much as you want to like do your routine, just get up, work out, go eat a nice lunch. It's all that's on your head is like tomorrow night's the real deal. Because even doing Fallon and Kimmel and all that, even though it is live, well, it's not live, you're filming at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And even though it is live in front of an audience, like if you mess up a word or two, most of those shows will let you go do it again. Even though you don't want to do it again, you can. SNL, you mess up, you're done. Your mess up is forever on national television and on YouTube.
Which is part of the show.
Yeah, for sure.
Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the day of the show like? Do you wake up like, is it almost like graduation or prom, or where you're like, you wake up, you don't get enough sleep, first day of school?
Oh yeah, dude. Like I remember going to bed that night. I was like, all right, I'm gonna get to bed at 10, get up at 7, I did like two vocal warm-ups that day. My vocal coach lives in New York, who I've never met. We always Skyped our lessons and finally got to meet her. And I got in bed at 10 and woke back up and couldn't go to bed till like 2 o'clock in the morning, then still popped up at 7 with these nerves. You're doing these vocal lessons, you're going, oh crap, do you hear that scratch in my throat? And your vocal coach is like, no, it sounds fine. And so you're just judging every bit of part of your day. And then finally you get there and you do a whole run through, like you run the entire show, like dress rehearsal at like 9 o'clock. Then you have to sit in your dressing room till midnight. And so you're just sitting there going, dear Lord, have mercy. You're watching all these people. You're watching all these, these skits go by and you're like, was that one going to make it? Is that one going to make it? And then the show comes on. Half the skits you thought were going to make it don't make it. Then you're like, all right, well, I got 20 minutes before I go sing. And then they pop in your room and you're like, hey, you have 3 minutes. And so you don't even have a chance to be nervous. Then you just get out there and you do it. You got one song done. They do more comedic skits, and then you do your other song. And then when it was over, dude, it was one of the most biggest, it was like the biggest weight off your shoulders you could ever imagine. Like in a good way.
Especially because you did well.
Yeah, and you did well. And
but you do it a first time. I mean, because they do that show twice, the SNL. They do one where you talk about the skit cutting.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you perform during that show too? Or
yeah.
No?
Okay, yeah, you do. So you perform four times in one night pretty much.
You do one, two during the show that doesn't get seen.
Correct.
Except they bring in a first audience who watches it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they go, okay, now we're going to go do the real show.
Yeah.
And they've cut a bunch of skits. And you still got to do your two songs.
Yeah, exactly.
But does it make it a little easier that you did it the first time and you kind of got out on stage and experienced it? Or is it still like, well, this one's live, crap?
Yeah, well, it is easier. But at the same time, you're like, okay, those two performances that we just did were flawless. The band was flawless. The horn parts were great. Now you're going, can we do it again with the same intensity and the same perfection? And I think that's where the nerves come in. But at the same time, dude, like anytime I've done live television, I don't even remember what happened. And I rarely ever go watch back my live performances because I always just critique the crap out of myself.
Yeah.
So I still haven't even seen what we did on SNL.
Oh, you didn't watch it?
Mm-mm.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I don't watch back what I do either because I just go, ooh, could have done that. Instead of going, oh, that was good, I go, it's like social media comments. Instead of going, hey, thank you for that nice comment, I just find the ones that rip me.
Totally.
And I'm like,
Durr. Yeah.
I can't.
Same, dude. We share that in common.
I was blocking people today. I got
right.
My thing is, I'm trying to eliminate negative influences around me.
Same.
I can only produce when I'm in an environment to produce.
Yeah.
And if I expect the best from me, which I do, why would I not put the best possible situation around me?
Totally.
And that's removing negative influences.
Yep.
Right. That's putting people that are great around me.
Yeah.
And part of that is, like, on stupid social media, people are screaming at me, calling me names. You didn't pay to be there.
That's true.
Block.
Yeah.
You ever block people?
Yes.
Yeah. The
craziest part is that when people continually comment to you and they follow you, it's like, why do you follow me? Like, I could get it if you kind of came across it on your search page and then you wanted to throw some hate my way, but it's just like, you follow me and all you do is rip me to shreds. Like, what is the point?
You ever hit one of them with a DM like, hey, just hope you're okay?
I'm getting better at that. I would say 2 years ago, Thomas Rhett responded to 80% of things that I didn't like. Have you ever met Bob Goff before?
No.
You know who Bob Goff is?
Tell me.
He's a book writer. He writes motivational books, but also sort of Christian-based. And I met him at a show in Hawaii, and he was randomly in Hawaii for a day doing a conference, and me and Lauren had lunch with him. And we just got into this conversation about this whole social media age and how do you deal with people that constantly just critique your Instagram page and just nothing but thumbs downs to your music and anything that you say. Like, you could say the sky's blue and they'd say it was green. Like, how do you deal with those kind of people? And as strange as this sounds, it really made a lot of sense. And he said that for the last 10 years of his life, every pair of pants he gets, he cuts the left pocket out of his pants. And I was like, that's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. And he does that as a metaphor. So, like, when he gets a lot of hate thrown his way, he calls those, like, left pocket things that when he puts them in that pocket, they just fall away. Another thing that he does is he'll get on an Instagram page of somebody that has slandered him or whatever, like on Instagram, and he'll go find something on their Instagram page in some way that person has been in pain. So whether they've lost a relative or whether they broke their leg or whatever, and instead of like commenting back, he just prays for them and then calls it a day. And that's something that I've been really trying hard to do because you never know where the pain's coming from, and you never know why that person is so miserable in the first place, and who am I to judge? It's easier for me to judge rather than like wonder why they're in that situation in the first place where they're on Instagram just like throwing hate people's way.
I also find because of that, like I'm more conscious of trying to be outwardly kinder.
Yeah, kill them with kindness, yeah.
And not even toward them, but just in general.
Right.
Like because at times that environment can be toxic.
Yeah.
So I will try to create in other people's space less toxicity.
Sure.
If it's writing a nice comment.
Right.
If it's sending a text, hey, that was great. So what I try to make it do to me is push me the other way.
Right.
Just like earlier when someone's like, that's not that funny. I'm like, all right, I got you. When someone's like, hey, your head looks humongous or you're not talented enough to be on, you're not famous. Why are you on Celebrity Family Feud?
Right.
It's like, all right, like I see your negativity here, but I'm going to take that. Like it stings a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use that as positive. I'm going to go make sure I go do something positive.
But not towards them,
just in general.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I let it push. And I don't do it to be awesome, but that's been my mechanism.
Yeah, but if it makes your head more positive, yes, and more level, and
that's
you can affect people in a positive way around you, then you know, good for that person that didn't like your comment or your joke.
It's kind of wild too. Like, your kids are going to grow up in an environment of knowing.
Terrifies me.
All the country stars.
I know.
L.A., New York.
Yep.
Like, they're going to have I say different, but I mean, you grew up knowing some of these guys. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you grew up in Nashville.
Yep.
Like, did you know McGraw?
I did.
From an early age?
Yeah. I mean, not so much McGraw. I mean, I met McGraw when I was 9. I met Garth when I was like 8 or 9 years old. We spent like a couple Halloweens over at Reba's house. Mostly people that Dad toured with, I knew pretty well. Blake Shelton, when he was back in his younger days. Not saying that you're old, Blake, just you were younger then.
He's a big fan. He'll for sure hear this.
Yeah, for sure. yeah, man, I definitely grew up in that environment, but it was so different. Social media didn't exist then. You know what I mean? Like, if there was an artist that did something that was worth talking about, it was in the newspaper. It's just so different now. Like, if something happens, it's immediately for anyone in the world to see.
Do you and Lauren have the talks about the kids on Instagram and the kids on Twitter? And, like, do you have rules?
We talk about it daily, man, and we get asked that question quite a bit. Like, what is the balance? And I think we're still trying to figure it out. But I think through it all, me and Lauren are still trying to be super real to how we like to live life. And ever since we got married, we were both 22 and we got married. And my fans have known that I was married since I was married. There was no ever trying to, like, be like, hey, I'm still the single dude. You know what I'm saying? Because I think in a lot of formats, it's like, well, you want to be accessible and you want to be the single guy because they think that it drives more fans your way. But that's never something that I really believed in. And so Lauren has been such a huge part of my social media platform that, like, when our kids got here, it was like, yeah, there's a lot of things that are too personal that we're definitely going to save for our own family group text and our private Instagram pages and stuff. But, like, I mean, you know, we're a family with two kids, and we're gonna project that. You know what I'm saying? And so there's a lot of people that are like, well, maybe that's not protective of your kids. And it's just like, well, they're part of our lives, and we've always been super transparent, and we've always kind of told whatever's on our sleeve is going to be kind of on Instagram, and we're pretty real about the stuff that we deal with and the stuff that we struggle with. I just think more so than anything, it's more of a, like you said, a positive influence to other families that have kids and just realize that every day is not rainbows and butterflies.
And also, nobody's wrong.
Right.
I mean, I think that's a thing to understand too, is that because somebody disagrees that you put your kids on Instagram.
Yeah.
And because maybe they don't, they're not right or wrong.
Exactly.
You're not right or wrong. There are, much like music, there are just different ways to do it.
Yeah, there's, yeah.
And it doesn't make you right or wrong.
You're right.
You can be different.
Yes.
And you don't have to hate somebody that's different.
Exactly.
But we're in that climate where it's like, social media climate, political climate. It's all the time.
It is so frustrating to me. Probably one of the biggest frustrating factors in my life of the last 5 years has been Instagram or Twitter or whatever.
And it's funny because Instagram is a big part of your successful career too, yet it's still one of the most frustrating parts of it as well.
Yeah, it's such a blessing and a curse, you know, because all you want to do is use your Instagram for a platform and use it to just promote positivity and love and peace and all these things. But it's just like, it doesn't matter what you or I post, there's going to be something ridiculous on there. I posted a picture yesterday or a video yesterday just of saying, like, what my new single was going to be. The first comment was, shave your beard. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, first of all, what are you doing in your life that you have time to just say that to me? You know what I'm saying? Like, or like, hey, bend the bill of your hat.
Like, but okay, let me play devil's advocate because I agree. What a dumb thing. But you remember that. Like, right
I
now,
I do. That's what I'm saying. I'm giving that person
noticed.
A thing.
They got noticed. It's I'm going to write on your next Instagram, I'm going to write, hey, bend the bill of your hat.
Right. And I'll remember that.
And see if I get some likes.
I know it.
On that. What's frustrating for me, and I don't know, again, I'm not speaking for you, but I know watching you, and I'm a big fan of how you do your music.
Thanks,
like,
man.
You're pretty unapologetic about, this is my style.
Sure.
Like, this is me, and okay, you can
get
on.
Well, the feeling is mutual, man. So
you can get on or you can get off the ride, but I'm just going to do what I do.
Yeah.
And I know that for me to watch at times some of, well, they call it the old guard, or to go, that guy's not country.
Yeah.
That frustrates me for you.
Right.
I don't know how you feel about that, but that for me, I'm like, God, if you guys even just knew, like, that dude is as country as can be.
Right. Yeah. Man, yeah. I mean, that's been my life as a country artist. Not necessarily in the beginning, but I'll say on my second record, when I started to, like, lean way more just progressive as far as production goes, and started to take my singing a whole lot more seriously and doing vocal lessons and all this stuff, trying to just make my records sound like something that wasn't happening in our genre. Dude, I have gotten more comments of you are not country or you are ruining the face of our genre. Might as well quit now. Like, I mean, if I could, I mean, there's, I mean, I'm sure that you've had some of those similar comments, but it's just like it, in the beginning of the of those days, it was just like, you know what, maybe they're right. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's the poor four in my Enneagram going, they're right. I suck. I'm defeated. It's better for me to quit for the whole world than to
you're
going to
take one for the world, the team.
I'm
going to
take
world.
One for the world. Yeah. But really, I'm taking one for like 60 people.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
A small vocal minority.
A very small vocal minority. And the more I thought about it, I was like, you're not country. You're not country. Okay, why? Why am I not country? Well, you don't wear cowboy boots on stage. Okay, let me mentally go through that. The reason I don't wear cowboy boots on stage is because I jump up and down like a crazy person. And on the Aldean tour in 2013, his thrust was this metal grating material. And I was wearing snip-toed cowboy boots and got stuck in them every night. That's the reason I don't wear cowboy boots on stage. Does that make me not country? I think no. You're not country because your music doesn't have a fiddle in it. I would say 98% of songs on country radio don't have a fiddle in it. There's another one. You know what I'm saying? And so you just have to like do this self-check. And I think through therapy and, you know, through talking with my wife and talking to people that I trust about it, it's just like, dude, at the end of the day, is country music not about being yourself? And is country music not about telling the truth in a story? Do I do both those things? Yes. Do I dress a little different? Yes. Are some of my songs more progressive than some things on country radio? Yes. I'm allowed to explore my outlets. You know what I'm saying? Like, you look back at any, and I think we've had this conversation before, but when Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson, all these dudes came out, they were called outlaws for a reason. An outlaw is not just a term that you use to describe country music. Today it is. Every 20 years, we look back at the artist 20 years ago and say that was real country music. You know what I'm saying? We say Shania Twain is real country music, but at the time, she was a pop singer.
They told her on Instagram to shave her beard. She was
oh my gosh.
They were like, I was talking to Garth, and he said the same. You know, that's my favorite one to share with people who go, oh, that's Garth's real country. Garth was like, dude, country music did not embrace me.
No.
He was like, they were anti-Garth Brooks. I came to town, and they were like, you're not country. Get out of here.
Right.
Like, what are you? And you can go through, and you can go back, and you mentioned some of those guys. But everyone that has changed the music for the better, because they're the ones who we remember as being successful,
right,
has been not country.
Exactly.
And
in any genre. People hated the Rolling Stones because they weren't the Beatles.
In any art.
In any
art.
It's
not even just music.
Yeah.
In any art whatsoever. You can look at comedy or visual art. Just whatever. People that break the mold and are not, get the finger like, you're not this, are the ones that create the new this.
Exactly.
And so that's always what's frustrated me for you. And partially too, I think, selfishly, when I came to town, it was, hey, you're not country. And I'm going, I grew up in Mountain Pine, Arkansas.
Right, yeah.
Like,
you lived
I
it,
lived
bud.
In a trailer.
Right.
Like, what animal do you want me to clean?
Right.
Because I can.
Yeah,
any
sure.
of them.
Yeah.
Like, and I started to think, what makes me not? I have an accent.
Yeah.
What makes me not country?
Right.
Was it because I was doing pop and hip hop for a while because that was where I got my first job?
Right.
I said, because I come on and I just tell my truth all the time.
Yeah.
I'm very authentic about my message.
Absolutely.
And CBS did a story like, he doesn't wear cowboy boots or a cowboy hat. He's the renegade.
Yeah.
I'm like, isn't country just telling the truth?
Yeah.
You don't have to be from the South. I am. You are.
Yeah.
So we kind of get that little nickel that we get
to
spend.
Yeah.
But
dude, I've seen more country folks in New York.
Upstate New York. That's what I was about to say.
I was just up there and it was country as crap.
Or like right outside of DC.
Yeah.
Like Northern Virginia.
Yep.
So like I feel your pain. And sometimes when I see people write stuff, I'm like, you know what? First of all, who cares? But second of all, I go, I know as a creator, after a while it starts to go, oh, it just gets to be a weight that you almost don't like to acknowledge because you're giving them power.
For sure.
But it's real, but it also makes me better too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's honestly, that's the one area in my life that's taken a lot of growing. But like you said, like when I do get those comments, it fuels my fire. It used to suck my life away, and now it fuels my fire.
Your dad's country. He was here.
My dad is country.
Your dad
crap.
Is, no one's going to see your dad and go, that guy ain't country.
Yeah. Oh, and that's my favorite comment I've ever gotten. Your daddy must be so ashamed.
Oh, people say that.
Oh, yeah. For about a year there, that was the special comment. Your daddy is ashamed of you. And I was like, I don't think he is.
Well, what a rotten thing.
That's what I'm saying.
That's a rotten thing to write.
Right.
Even for trolls.
Exactly.
Like, I lost a little faith in all trolls that they actually write that.
And I know
I already didn't have a good opinion of them. What's the relationship with you and your dad now?
It's amazing, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me and Dad have gone through a bunch of seasons in our life, from high school playing football into, you know, signing a record deal and kind of starting the career to kind of getting into my career and kind of finding my own voice, my own sound, and then to now, going through a lot of different phases in life and all good. You know, I think every father and son has their definite ups and downs, but I would say that me and my dad today at 29 and almost 50 are in the best place we've ever been in our father-son relationship. Because, like, he's so young. I mean, he had me when he was 19, or my mom had me when she was 19. And so to have a young parent that is, I think, because I feel like I'm kind of a young parent, and I feel like when I'm 50, I'm going to be a lot different to my kids then than I am now, because I think parents just go through continuous learning phases. But my dad is obviously my dad, but he's also like one of my best friends in the world, you know, so he's on tour with us this year, brings his wife out on the road. And when my kids come out, they flock to my dad. Like, they're obsessed with my dad. They call him Popeye. And, I think for the longest time, I was like, what is my dad going to be like as a grandfather? And he's like the best grandfather in the world. And we get to write during the day. We get to play shows at night. And, I just feel like he's just become kind of a person that doesn't have, so, I mean, he obviously is very focused and very driven and wants to be an amazing songwriter, but I think a lot of the pressure of going, how do I keep doing this, has kind of left him as he's turned 48 to 50. I just feel like he's got a lot less pressure on his shoulders, and I think it's kind of made our relationship a lot better, and he's given me a lot more, you know, older man wisdom, I think.
Did he encourage you early on to start music?
Not really, man. My dad never pressured me to do a lot, but his big thing was don't quit anything. You know what I mean? Like, we battled that for a while, like in high school, like going to football camp. No one likes football camp. I don't care if you're the best football player in the world, you hate football camp. And like, I was like, I just want to quit and play baseball. Or I want to quit and go do this or that. And he'd be like, well, you signed up, you're not quitting. And so when it came to music, he was very weird about it, because I think he did it, you know, for 10 to 12 years, and he knows the highs and he knows the lows and he knows what failure feels like and what success feels like. And I think any dad would want to kind of give their kid whatever they can expect and then be like, hey, now you can make the decision, but I want you to know that it's not going to be an easy road. And so him and my mom both were like, are you sure that you want to get into music? And when I turned about 19 years old, it was really the only thing in life that I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was write songs. All I wanted to do was play shows. Anything about creating anything, that's what I wanted to do. So,
do you look back now and see that you're your father's son?
Yes.
Maybe you didn't see it then, but now you look back and go,
I didn't see it a lot then, but now I'm looking at the way that I parent, the way that he parented, and we are a lot alike in a lot of ways, and we are still very different in a lot of ways, but more so alike.
What was your first cut ever?
A song called I Ain't Ready to Quit by Jason Aldean. And the taste
of your sweet kiss. 2010, you were still in school at the time.
Yep. And I was at Lipscomb University down the street, yeah.
And you get a cut.
Yeah.
What's that like?
I thought that I was a gajillionaire. And I probably made $100 off that cut. But I remember when that came out, dude, it was like all my buddies in college. I remember we went to Walmart that night, and we all bought two copies of the record. And we parked my truck in the front yard of this little house next to Lipscomb, and we had a party to one song. We literally just played this song on repeat for like 6 hours. It was just the coolest thing that had ever happened to me in my entire life.
You signed a record deal like a year later?
A year later, yeah.
Did you do the, let me talk to some record labels. Did you do the showcases for people?
I did.
Was it they all offering you deals? Like, what was the Thomas Rhett record label kind of pursuit like?
They did, man. I think I played for six or seven record labels. And the only song that I had that I thought was even remotely good was a song called If I Could Have a Beer with Jesus that was on my first record. And every label that I played for a day later had offered me a record deal. And I couldn't believe it, because all I thought I wanted to be was a songwriter. I just wanted to follow in Dad's footsteps. Like, I don't think I wanted to go on the road. I wanted to play shows, but I didn't think I wanted to do the thing. Go on radio tour, sign a record, do all that stuff. But as I got into it, started to get some cuts, it gave me the bug, because when I wrote the songs, instead of other people singing them, I really wondered what it would be like if I recorded them and put them on the radio. And so once I signed a record with Big Machine, I think it was 2011. It's just kind of been a roller coaster since then, but it was definitely the right thing for sure.
Like, what in your mind? Wait, when you wake up in the morning, you go, "All right, micro and macro. There's a big difference, and I believe we have to have micro goals. Like, what am I going to do today?
Yeah.
What am I going to do this hour? I'm a big believer in writing things down and declaring even to yourself what you want, because then if you don't get it or you do get it, there's a win or loss there. I'm big on, I need marks in my life.
Sure, yeah.
And then the macro goals, which are, this is what I'd like to be in 5-10 years. Mm-hmm. This is what I'd like to be for my career. So micro goals first. Like, what are your goals this week, this month?
Like as a today
as
human
you
being
right now.
My micro goals are to really be more of a content human being. That may fit into micro and macro, but I want to be more content. I want to be more patient.
I believe it has to be micro before it's macro.
Yeah.
So when I say that,
okay,
it's also an elevator.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just go big. If you don't do the small things right, you're definitely not going to do the big things right.
Yeah, that's true. I think my two biggest hindrances in life are my, sometimes I love where I am for like 2 days, but there always has to be something else. Does that make sense?
Are you someone who's never satisfied?
I'm satisfied for a time, and not necessarily in my family. Actually, not at all in my family. I love sitting with my kids. I love hanging out with my wife. I love doing vacations with my kids, but especially in my career, like, me and my manager had a long talk about this the other day, because on the road lately, like, I just put a record out a month ago and I've had nothing but songwriters out with me every single weekend, and we write like 10 songs in a weekend. And so the benefit of that is that you wrote 10 songs. The downside is that when you get to your Saturday show, you're praying all day that your voice works because you've done nothing but sing demos. And there's a part of me that's like, why am I writing songs right now? I literally just put a record out. But it's the fact that the record came out, and even though it's only a month old, in my brain, it's been out for a year. And so I'm like, okay, I'm falling behind. And so I don't know if it's more of a content thing or if it's more of like, I always have to keep growing, and there always has to be a new song. There always has to be a new tour. There always has to be a new this. I think the search for, I wish the search for new would not stop, but would just kind of taper a little bit.
Do you talk to your therapist about this?
Yeah. And I don't know if that comes from, we talk about the Enneagram 4 times, but I don't know if it comes from that mindset. That's just how my brain is wired. But even as a kid, dude, like, it was always what else is there? What's next? But it's always in more career driven goals than it is in family. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and it does. And also, I can feel that you've been working on this because you have acknowledgement of your being.
Yes.
And the first way to fix a problem, and not even to fix a problem, but to address a problem, is know you have, we'll call it a problem.
Yeah. It is a problem.
To you right now, it's a problem. But what I found with my issues, my problems, is they're also what make me. The same way we talked about Instagram.
Yep.
Like, your problem is that you got to keep doing what's been making you so successful.
Right.
Like, you feel like you got to keep going. You've also been doing it forever.
Right.
So it's hard to change.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, but I can hear that you are repair. I use the words problem and repair because it's the first word we gravitate to.
Yeah.
You're trying to repair yourself in your mind.
Yes.
And by doing that, you've got to acknowledge where the part is broken in the car.
Totally. Yeah.
And so your growth is just kind of acknowledging this. Yeah. And you're never going to fix it.
No, I know.
It's not to be fixed, though.
Right.
Like, it really isn't to be fixed. It's just to be acknowledged and monitored and not let it get out of control.
Yeah, for sure. Because it definitely bleeds into my family life a little bit. Like, there's a lot of the times that we're standing in the kitchen, just me and, like, my entire family came over. And my wife will look at me and she'll go, where are you right now? And I'm in a song. Like, I'm literally writing another verse. And those are parts of me that I wish I could change, because one day my kids aren't going to be little, and I don't want to look back in 20 years and go, I was writing songs while my kids were growing up, in a metaphorical kind of language, you know? And I just wish, you know, like, I love the fact that I'm always striving for something new and something better and something different, because I think if you stop evolving, then you stop growing. But, you know, at least for the sake of my wife and for my kids, I do wish that when I came home, my brain could remotely be turned off of work a little bit more than it is. You know what I'm saying?
And I think 9% you can fix it.
Yeah.
But you never want to fix it 60%.
Right.
That's just not who you are.
Right.
And I think I can tell you know that too.
Yeah. I definitely know it. Yeah.
Like, right now you're writing a song instead of doing this podcast. Like, I'm like, where are you? Yeah. Where are you right now?
I know.
He's like, I'm writing a song. What do you talk about Lauren and the kids. Like, what do you feel like the biggest, because you write all these songs and it's a lot of stories about your life and situations.
Yeah.
What do you feel like the biggest misconception is about you guys?
Well, I feel like I tried to fix that misconception on this record a little bit. I think me and you have talked about it. Me and Amy for sure have. But, like, like on a song called Dream You Never Had, or Notice, like those two songs are really way more in depth into me and Lauren's relationship than I think people are aware of. Like, I think sometimes people look at our marriage and they go, nothing is wrong with them. Just based off our Instagram, because we do this and we're traveling there and we're taking these pictures on a beach, and it's like, well, their life is so perfect. And it's just like, I think the misconception is that mine and Lauren's life with our kids is rainbows and butterflies. It is just as crazy and messed up and chaotic as everybody else. And I think that would be a misconception for sure.
Tell me about 147 million orphans.
So 147 million orphans changed to Loved One. My wife and the kind of the creators of the company kind of rebranded it and called it Loved One. And I think after Lauren had gone to Uganda several times, she knew she wanted to be a part of it. So she was added to the board of 147. And then as she got involved, they changed the name to Loved One. And Loved One means like if everyone loved one person, which like if everyone could care for one person, then there might not be as big of an orphan issue. You know, they provide water, health, food. Mainly their focus is in Masindi, Uganda, which is where Willa Gray's from. And they take, you know, random teams of, you know, 20 and 30, like three or four times a year over there to help work and kind of help fix and kind of brainstorm about, you know, kind of the future of what we can do in Masindi.
I love it that you found something you're passionate about and you work toward helping it, both you and Lauren.
Yeah.
A struggle that I had, because I'm so close to Amy, and I went over to Haiti and was at the orphanage, and
yeah,
people would go, why are you not helping people down the street?
I know.
And I would go, and for a while, my heart hurt for Amy having to deal with this.
Yeah. We got that a lot too.
And I can only imagine.
Yeah.
But I would say, and I would get on, and I don't say it anymore because it's like, it's a vocal minority.
Yeah.
And there's a realization in me that goes, most people don't feel this way.
Right.
But I would say, you know, why should we limit our giving to proximity?
Yeah.
Meaning, if I find something I'm passionate about and I want to give to it,
yeah,
who are you to judge me on what right. I'm doing?
Yeah.
And then who am I to care that you're judging me? And then it comes back to me. It's always a me thing.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, should we base giving on how close someone is to us? And if yeah. so, why aren't you helping someone four houses down than nine houses down?
For sure.
Are they more important because they're a block away than someone who's right. a mile away? Because according right. to your logic, we can only help people that we can touch,
yeah.
and then we need to work our way out.
For sure.
But I just know that from being with Amy, and she got it worse than even I did when we basically rebuilt that orphanage.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was something that you guys struggled with a bit.
We definitely do, man. We still struggle with it. You know, I mean, you're never going to escape those comments, especially when it comes to something like adoption. You're never going to escape some of those comments of going, well, that's not your kid. You know what I'm saying? And that is the most hurtful comment on the planet, because you realize, yes, I'm not Willa Gray's biological father. But you know, due to certain circumstances, I am. You know what I mean? Like I'm her dad, and Lauren is her mom, and you know, I think that the Lord places different things on different people's hearts at different times. And so, like you said, for you to be like, well, why, you know, there's kids that need helping here. And I'm like, I realize that. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's still my part to help in Nashville just as much of it is as it in Uganda. But for some reason, the Lord put Masindi on our hearts, and that's where we've been for the last 3 or 4 years, and we'll be there as long as it stays on our heart.
And also, human beings are human beings. If you can help a human being, then go help a human being.
Right.
Why we let a proximity
I agree.
Be a factor in why we do or don't help?
For sure.
It drives me crazy.
Yeah, it drives me crazy too, man.
And even outside of, like, I'll do things for animals. Well, why don't you help people? Well, I do help people, douchebag. Don't get me started. But yes, it's almost like regardless of what you do,
yeah,
according to the outside of the bubble, you can't do enough.
Yeah, for sure. You really can't, man.
Look at this. I'm getting all fired up over here for you.
I appreciate that.
You got two kids. That's a lot. You got like your dad. You're on the road. You're being kid dad. You're being the star.
Hey, can you pause? Can we pause this or no?
Well, yeah, we can do whatever we want.
I was going to tell you, me and Tyne talked about this. So we're pregnant again, and it's we're releasing it tomorrow. Is there any way that you would save that for tomorrow?
Yeah, save it tomorrow.
Okay, cool.
Actually, we don't even need to pause it. We'll just not put it up till tomorrow.
Sick.
We'll just let it keep running
okay,
right now.
For you. Yeah, there you go. So we're having another baby.
So you just heard how he told me, I don't even want to remove that. Let's leave that in. So you're having another baby.
Yes.
Wait, are you having a baby or are you adopting?
We're having a baby.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at that.
It's pretty wild, man.
Potent you are.
I know, and it's a girl.
Three girls.
Yeah. Just when I thought life could not get any crazier, we're having another girl.
And when is the baby going to be here? Do you know?
February 3rd.
And you know it's a girl.
Yeah. We did the blood test thing, you know, where you can do the genetic testing.
I don't know, but that's what they do now.
So you can do a blood, I think it's 10 weeks where you can do a blood test and you can find out the gender and you can find out, you know, kind of all the stuff about your baby. And so, yeah, we're having a girl. We found out yesterday, our whole family came over and we shut off these cannons that blow either blue or pink colors. And my whole family was convinced it was a boy. Like, I already had boy names picked out. And we shot these cannons off and it was pink. And I was like, dear Lord, three weddings.
That's true. As a dad.
Yeah.
You're going to have to marry off three daughters.
Three daughters. And we're not even done. I mean, Lauren wants to have five kids, so who knows?
Oh, congratulations, man. That's freaking crazy.
It's crazy. I know. Thank you very much.
Look at you.
Yeah.
You're like 15. You got three kids. I'm over here like 70. I'm
30, bro. I'm about to be 30.
Three girls.
Yeah.
Now, are you shooting toward five? Or are you going to shoot toward until you get a boy? Like, what's in your mind? Are you just shooting toward, let's just get this one and make sure everything comes out all right?
Yeah, we're definitely focused on this one for sure. Me and Lauren both would love to adopt again whenever the time was right. And I mean, Lauren's number is five. I think when we get to five, my wife will probably be like, we can do six. That's just the kind of person my wife is. In my brain, I'm going, how are we going to do this? Like, we're going to have nine tour buses for our girls on the road. So my head goes to more of the math of the whole situation. But I, you know, having girls, man, I think before we had kids, I always thought that I was meant to be kind of the dad that had boys. But now that I've had girls, my heart has softened so much. And I've never looked at anybody like I look at my girls. Like, it is nuts. The emotion that you feel when your girl, when you put them down to bed and you say, all right, love you, baby girl. And they're like, I love you, daddy. Like, it breaks your heart every single time. So in that aspect, I'm beyond excited to have a girl, but I do look forward to hopefully having a boy one day.
Look at you.
Yeah.
You can have three kids.
I know.
Man, I don't even know what to say right now. Look at you. That is awesome. Well, we got just a couple minutes left here. Yeah. Let's roll over. I'd like to talk about, a couple things. One, these would be kind of quick hits. Just give me your thoughts on this. I feel like, and I've told this to you off a mic and off camera too, like, and you've won Male Vocalist of the Year at the ACMs.
Yeah.
Like, I think you're next one up for that Entertainer of the Year. And the way this goes is you have to get in it before you can win it.
Right.
You got to be invited to the party. You don't win the party the first time you're invited to the party. And I feel like you're now at that level.
Yeah.
It's just the gatekeepers, whatever that means, because it changes all the time. They got to say, all right, guy that's kind of pushing the limits, you're pushing them, they just got, it's wild, but it's your turn. Like, it's absolutely your turn.
I appreciate that, man.
How do you feel when I say that?
It's first of all, I never in a million years thought anyone would ever say that about me. But if I think back 5 years ago, that's everything that I was ever working towards anyways. I mean, Entertainer of the Year is kind of the cherry on top of the awards at any award show. And I'll never forget the first time Luke Bryan won it. I'll never watch Jason Aldean win it. I'll never forget watching Jason win it for the first time. And I think when I was touring with those people, I always knew, I was like, dude, these dudes, this is insane what they're doing. The people they're putting in these venues, the production that they have, the amount of hits that they have. And I feel like we're definitely not in that lane yet of having, I think Aldean has like, 25, 26 number one songs.
Yeah, but you have 13 number one songs, so you are.
We're close. We're getting there, man. And we work. Have you ever seen the James Brown documentary, how hard he made his band work? I'm not like that hard on my band, but we work really hard.
He would fire them in the show.
Yeah. And I mean, we bring on choreographers, not even to teach us how to dance, but just how to teach our band where to be, when to be, how to move. I mean, our trumpet player named Sharif is our hype man. And like, literally, like, he's the person that introduces all the band members. I've never seen anybody in country music do that. And so it's like, how every year do you... How do you spend your month of rehearsal time making sure that the record, that your show sounds exactly like the record with just the right touch of live element? How do you make it to where even your ballads feel like up-tempos? And how do you make the person in section 301 go, oh, he's playing a new song, now it's time to go get a beer? And I feel like those are things, when you can think about them, you really can work up a show, just like in your stand-up and in your bit. You're just like, how do I make this the most intriguing thing someone has ever watched? And we really have worked hard for that, man. So even to be, just like you said, invited to the party at some point in the future, would be a huge win for us, but we look forward to that.
It should be now. Based on numbers, it should have already been. But again, because you're so progressive, you have, you know, 1 in 7 who's like, "Murr."
Right.
As long as you make that 1 in 10 or 1 in 11, you're in.
Yeah, for sure.
So, like, to me, you're there. And I've told you that. I'm not even saying that because we're on this together. I just wanted to say that publicly with you in front of me.
Thank you.
Let me say before you leave, on August 4th, we are hosting the CMA Fest together.
That's right.
As I
Bobby taught me everything that I know on that, by the way.
No, I didn't. I didn't teach you anything.
You did. I asked you a million questions.
But you were already good. It didn't matter.
Yeah, but you helped me be great, so I appreciate it.
August 4th, oh, people check it out. Not only does TR host it, he also, like a boss, gets up and plays. It's just you do it all.
Thanks, man.
You
do too, man.
I don't do crap.
I just want to say this because I feel like I don't know. You affirm a lot of people and you don't get, I don't know, you might get a lot of affirmation, but I just want to give you an encouraging word. You have inspired me to do a lot of things I probably never would have done in the first place. Your openness. I haven't read the full book, but I've read up to like chapter 6, and there's a lot of inspiring stuff in there, and I just love your story. I love the way you live life. I love that you're just unabashedly you, whatever word that is. And it's really inspiring to a lot of people. It really is. So don't change you, because you're pretty awesome.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'm not comfortable with that.
It's okay. Just take it.
I kind of lower my head. I don't do well with compliments. listen, we've done 1 hour and 10 minutes.
Cool.
This has been Jeff, fun?
I had a blast. I could do this forever, man. This is so fun.
You've went from high-heeled flip-flops to Thomas Rhett.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
The very first time I saw your tattoo, I thought it said HHFF.
From your old band?
Yes.
High-heeled flip-flops. Yeah. I'm a massive fan.
When I saw it, I was like, holy crap. What does it say again?
So my grandmother, who adopted me for a while,
okay,
when my mom left, her name was Hazel Hurt.
Okay.
And she passed away. And my mom, when she died, her name is Pam Hurt. And so it's their initials,
gotcha,
both on my arm.
That's awesome.
And I have Arkansas on the back. And I have little letters, Mirror Ball on the back when I won that, because Sean and I got that.
Sick.
I got to get a microphone. I promised the listeners, because when I got put in the Radio Hall of Fame, that I would get a microphone tattooed on my arm. I haven't done that yet. And then, of course, I have a big penis on my back.
No, you don't.
It goes all the way from my belt all the way up to the back of my neck.
No, it doesn't.
You haven't seen the penis on my back?
Is this real?
You haven't seen the big
Let
penis?
Let me see.
I don't have a penis on my back.
Oh, I was about to freak out.
All right, listen. We've said it all, I feel like. I appreciate your openness and your candor. And congratulations on another baby.
I appreciate that.
Got to get me one of those.
Right.
Oh, I got to get a girlfriend first. But I guess you don't have to have a girlfriend to have a baby.
No, you don't.
There are a few ways you could do that.
There are.
It's been a good talk here. Thomas Rhett, at Thomas Rhett Akins on Instagram. Be nice. He's not going to shave his beard or fix the bill of his hat.
That's right.
I think we've learned that. Check him out on CMA Fest August 4th, hosting and performing, and he's on the Very Hot Summer Tour, the VHS Tour. And I got a couple buddies out there with you on tour, too.
That's right.
Russell's out there, huh?
Yeah, Russell, Dustin, and my
Dustin.
Daddy.
Yeah, yep. And your dad. Well, good to see you, bud.
You too, man.
Really.
Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Here we go, episode 189 with Thomas Rhett.